$355 million profit in 2021. They went from a $220 million loss in the January to June 2020 period to a $599 million profit in 2021. In spite of the above numbers, many citizens are also realizing that the idea of the Second Amendment guaranteeing the right of individual gun ownership is radical and wrong, and was never intended by the founders to be a barrier to establishing a stringent weapons safety and control laws for the U.S. community. Turning gun violence into a mental health problem is incorrect, dangerous, and irresponsible, as anyone with even minimal knowledge of mental health issues knows. It's of course true people who kill children en masse are crazy, but asserting this reality says nothing. All countries have mentally ill and violent people, but U.S. citizens are increasingly more aware that only the United States of America arms them. Although the U.S. public is demanding real changes for much better safety and weapons regulation, the toxic results of U.S. current lack of adequate weapons control policies continues its deadly pace. The United States of America cannot any longer allow the profiteering military-industrial complex and their beholden politicians to get away with hiding or changing the subject, hoping the public forgets about the problem until the next mass shooting. By using denial over many years to reject and avoid the need for stringent gun control legislation, the GOP and some Democrats have fallen into a miasma of self-induced indifference and dangerous permissiveness toward gun ownership and its deadly consequences. The large number of weapons in the U.S. is not only highly profitable for the weapons industry, but also further supports the myth that guns are necessary to maintain the image of rugged individualism. This is why resistance to legislative proposals to better gun control culture and gun violence itself seem to many gun owners as attacks on their own personality and national identity. The bigger, more powerful the weapon, the more powerful the gun owner feels. Many marginalized and enraged lone wolf murderers, thanks to easy access to assault-style weapons, can misuse Second Amendment gun rights to cleanse the world. 21st century U.S. culture still venerates violence with the U.S. myth of heroic frontier psychology, but at the very high cost of crippling and killing American children. Historian Roxanne Dunbar-Oritz, in her book Loaded, A Disarming History of Second Amendment, gives alarming statistics about weapons and gun deaths in the United States of America. There are 310 million firearms in the United States, 114 million handguns, 110 million rifles, and 86 million shotguns. The number of military-style assault weapons in private hands, including AR-15 semi-automatic rifles used in the massacres at Majority Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, is estimated at 1.5 million. The United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, an average of 90 firearms per 100 people. The total gun deaths in the United States of America average around 37,000 a year, with two-thirds of those deaths being suicides, leaving approximately 12,000 homicides, 1,000 of those at the hands of the police. Mass shootings, ones that leave four or more people wounded or dead, now occur in the United States on average at the pace of one or more per day. Disturbing as that fact is, mass shootings currently account for only 2% of gun killings annually. And the number of gun deaths, 37,000, is roughly equal to deaths by vehicle incidents in the United States per year. The Second Amendment, written by James Madison, adopted in 1791, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Although generations of activists, gun owners, and jurists have disagreed about how this should be interpreted in a modernizing world, what has been recognized is what the Second Amendment was really to be used for. History professor Roxanne Dunbar Orritt's document Sin loaded a disarming history of the Second Amendment, the purpose of armed militias of the Second Amendment. The kind of militias and gun rights of the Second Amendment had long existed in the 13 British colonies and were expected to continue fulfilling two primary roles in the new United States. Number one, destroying native communities in the armed march to possess the continent. And number two, brutally subjecting the enslaved African population. Dunbar Orritt demonstrates that the violence sanctioned by the Second Amendment was a key factor in transforming America into a militaristic business powerhouse. As the fledgling nation embarked on its relentless westward expansion in the 19th century, the labor of powerful, meanwhile, America's gun culture was growing in tandem with the country's increasingly sophisticated publishing and firearms manufacturing industries. Pulp novels romanticized ex-Confederate soldiers and rifle-wielding frontiersmen. Brand name weapons acquired a special status. In the two decades after the Civil War, Dunbar Orritt writes, the Winchester rifle was fetishized for killing Indians, and the cult revival for outlawry. In the process, gun violence and civilian massacres were not just normalized, but commercially glorified, packaged, promoted, and mass marketed. In 21st century America, fantasy and myth about frontier psychology still continue being played out by Hollywood, video internet games, and other manufactured fantasies that promote weapon sales. Just as communities today rely on professional public health experts in epidemiology to control the incidence, distribution and control of disease in any population, so too for public safety and health, we should rely on experts in weapons control and distribution to advise and design adequate, stringent legislation for community weapons control or regulation. The profile of a gun safety program could include, number one, prior to approving access to any weapon, potential weapon owners should be required to get formal instruction and pass a rigorous background check. Number two, an annual inspection by law enforcement authorities on how ammunition and weapons are stored, plus full inspection of weapons themselves, should be conducted. Number three, banned weapons should be collected by law enforcement as well. And number four, reimbursement, if any, for banned firearms would be the responsibility of the taxpayer and should be considered an investment in public safety. After mass shootings, many have or will use an amateur or banal analysis of the psychology of killers to provide much-needed camouflage for the profiteering military gun industrial complex NRA. Declare that it is a mental health, behavioral health problem, all in the killer's mind, and perhaps we will notice that pathetic U.S. state local non-controlled weapons policy results in amazingly high murder rates, suicides, and frequent mass murders. When deranged people have such remarkably easy access to arsenals of weapons, every so often one of them will go ballistic. We can't eliminate all political, religious extremism, or mental illness, but we can most certainly prevent people from having access to rapid-fire semi-automatic weapons and thousands of rounds of ammo. The UK has 1/6 Americans murder rate. not because they are psychologically healthier or nicer than the United States of America. The UK and many other countries just don't have or allow the weaponry hardware to be available to do as much damage. Thousands of prayers and thoughts are of little value unless Americans accept the fact that their laws reducing access to weapons need to be greatly strengthened, not loosened. Gun supporters and expedient politicians who take NRA, firearms industry and other military-industrial complex, big donor money while expressing heartfelt prayers, thoughts, and condolences for dead children, grieving parents, and disrupted communities are disingenuous, disgusting, and deserving of maximum shame for their preposterous and irresponsible scapegoating of the mentally ill, while letting politicians, devotees of loose access laws, and the profiteering gun industry itself continue to squirm out of any responsibility.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations. U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
The U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack. In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed. The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York. The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people. That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society. The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ebrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament to, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ebrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman. An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman, being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together. Look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and a robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China, and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018, when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks. Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernize Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Researchers found that reducing the amount of air-based pollutants would have a profound impact on public health in the immediate term, and that it would also have long-term positive effects when it comes to transitioning away from unsustainable energy sources and addressing the climate crisis as a whole. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading Eliminating Air Pollution Could Save More Than 53,000 Lives Per Year, study says. Here's the story. A new study has concluded that tens of thousands of premature deaths in the U.S. could be avoided if air pollution was reduced or completely eliminated. The study, published by researchers from the University of Wisconsin, UW, in the journal GeoHealth, recently notes that by eliminating air pollution resulting from energy-related activities in the U.S., more than 53,000 premature deaths could be avoided on an annual basis. The prevention of those deaths would also save $608 million in benefits relating to illnesses and deaths caused by air pollution. The UW researchers reached this conclusion by analyzing data from the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, and by using health models to gauge the benefits of eliminating air-polluting particulates, including sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides. These particles get deep into the lungs and cause both respiratory and cardiac ailments, said Jonathan Petz, a UW professor and one of the study's authors, adding they are pretty much the worst pollutant when it comes to mortality and hospitalization. While states could still potentially save lives if they acted alone, there would be greater benefits with higher levels of cooperation due to how these types of particulates transport themselves over state lines, noted the study's lead author, graduate student Nicholas Malex, adding, if Wisconsin were to act alone, they get a certain amount of benefit, but if they act in concert with partners in the region or as part of a nationwide effort, you get more benefit. Researchers found that reducing the amount of air-based pollutants would have a profound impact on public health in the immediate term, and that it would also have long-term positive effects when it comes to transitioning away from unsustainable energy sources and addressing the climate crisis as a whole. Many other research studies have come to similar conclusions. A study from last year, for example, found that 74 million lives could be saved by the end of this century if energy-based air pollution was eliminated by the year 2050. A reduction in pollutants would also likely benefit groups of people who are more susceptible than others to these types of pollutants, an EPA report stated. These groups include children, pregnant women, older adults, and individuals with pre-existing heart and lung disease, the EPA said, as well as people in low socioeconomic neighborhoods and communities that may be more vulnerable to air pollution.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. A personality like Hamza is an unknown personality. We should teach ourselves and our people to think carefully on various matters and to make a correct decision. Had we but listened or used our intelligence, we should not now be among the companions of the blazing fire. They will then confess their sins. Chapter 67, verses 10 to 11. If we do not listen and think carefully, this is a sin. The Holy Quran says this clearly. According to the Commander of the Faithful, as quoted by Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and greetings be upon him, Hazrat Hamza was a manifestation of among the believers of men who have been true to their covenant with God. How does being true to their covenant with God take place? The full and complete form of it is to become a role model for divine teachings and divine commands and stepping forward for the path that God has specified. That is, such personalities become a manifestation of these qualities. We should learn this. God willing, if special people in society try to produce such personalities, each of them will be able to save society in sensitive times. This is really the case.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We should not be satisfied with training certain individuals or preaching them so that they will believe in something in one way or another. No organization should focus the efforts on creating such personalities. Thankfully, Jamaat al-Mustafa, the International Al-Mustafa University, can be an active center in these areas. In Qom, the centers which have thankfully been created can ensure this. We need to thank the efficient management of the Islamic seminaries. Some promotional organizations are also working well in this regard. We must build personalities who can be a manifestation of divine and Islamic teachings and rules. If such personalities are built, then the formation of the Islamic civilization will be definite. If it is done, there will be no doubts about its formation. I hope that God will reward you and make you successful so that you can carry out this task and future tasks in the best way possible. I, for one, thank you all you gentlemen who are undertaking this responsibility. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has the most number of weapons, with an estimated 400 million guns in circulation. That's more guns than people in the United States, and almost half of the civilian-owned guns on the planet. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan, writers. This article is published under the heading, "Gun Massacres Are the Grotesque Pinnacle of American Exceptionalism." Here's the story. "Together we rise" reads the motto on a wall of Robb Elementary School in Ovalle, Texas. The school serves about 600 students in the second through fourth grades. Over 90% are Latinx. 19 children between the ages of 9 and 11 and two of their teachers were murdered there recently by an 18-year-old gunman armed with a semi-automatic AR-15 rifle. The shooter, Salvador Ramos, was killed at the school by a U.S. Border Patrol agent. At a news conference recently, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican who consistently rejects gun control, blamed the shortage of mental health services for the atrocity. Manny Oliver, whose son, Joaquin, was killed in the Parkland, Florida school massacre in 2018, said on the Democracy Now! News Hour, "This is not about mental health. That happens all around the planet. This is about guns and easy access to guns." In the middle of Governor Abbott's briefing, Beto O'Rourke, who is running against Abbott in the upcoming gubernatorial election, interrupted saying, "The time to stop the next shooting is right now, and you are doing nothing. You said this is not predictable. This is totally predictable." Others on the stage cursed at O'Rourke, demanding he leave as police closed in O'Rourke exited. His accusations were echoed in a tweet by Amanda Gorman, the youngest presidential inaugural poet in U.S. history, who wrote, "It takes a monster to kill children, but to watch monsters kill children again and again and do nothing isn't just insanity, it is inhumanity." Many U.S. politicians parrot the line that this is the greatest nation on earth. American exceptionalism is ingrained in the U.S. culture. Americans have the most number of weapons, with an estimated 400 million guns in circulation. That's more guns than people in the United States, and almost half of the civilian-owned guns on the planet. Americans are without question number one when it comes to mass shootings. The Gun Violence Archive has counted 213 so far this year alone, and more than 3,000 since 2014. A shocking number of U.S. mass shootings take place in schools. According to the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, there have been 2,054 school shootings in the United States since 1970, with 681 deaths. Canada has had a total of 8 school shootings in about the same time frame, from 1975, with a total of 31 victims killed. Mexico has had 17 school shootings since 2004, with 15 victims killed. In Australia in 1996, a young man with an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle massacred 35 people in the tourist town of Port Arthur, Tasmania. Australia is a country of gun lovers, but reaction to the shooting was swift, with a popular national mandatory gun buyback for semi-automatic guns. Some 643,000 guns were collected and destroyed. Since then, Australia has experienced just one mass shooting of the type that occurs almost daily in the U.S. Similar policies were established in other wealthy industrialized nations in the wake of mass shootings in Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and Norway. When access to guns is restricted and gun ownership is more difficult, gun violence dramatically drops. There is consensus on tightening gun laws in the United States. Preventing those suffering from mental illness from owning or accessing guns has between 85 to 90% bipartisan support, according to the Pew Research Center. Banning clips that hold more than 10 bullets has 64% bipartisan support. A federal database tracking every gun sale enjoys 66% support. Why won't elected officials heed the electorate? One clear reason is the decades of lobbying by the National Rifle Association. The American gun lobby, supported by American gun manufacturers, is alive and well. Robin Lloyd, managing director of Giffords, the organization dedicated to preventing gun violence led by former Congress member Gabby Giffords, who was shot in the head in a mass shooting in Tucson, said, "The National Rifle Association has been weakened by self-inflicted wounds of greed and mismanagement of funds. Another organization is the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which spends more on lobbying against gun violence prevention measures in Washington than NRA does. They are the true face of the American corporate gun lobby." Nicole Golden, executive director of Texas Gun Sense, organizes for Common Sense Gun Control in the Lone Star State. "I've been involved in gun violence prevention in Texas for almost a decade," she said on Democracy Now!, adding, "our work has basically been shut down. Despite the power of the gun lobby, she's not without hope," saying, "we are here for the long haul. We're not going anywhere. We will keep chipping away, working in our communities to pass meaningful change and building this extremely strong movement." As the children of Robb Elementary School proclaim, "Together we rise."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi,
Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The road to Svetlodarsk, a town in Donbass recently taken by the Russian army and separatist militias. The town is home to around 10,000 people, most of whom stayed during the fighting. I'm surprised to see little damage here.
Nothing happened, fortunately, in the town itself. But the joint forces of the DPR, LPR, and Russia broke the so-called Svetlodarsk Arc, and the enemy lost all interest in fighting and left, so the battle is now behind the town. Kiev do not give their army enough motivation. We're on our land, and we're defending it. And at the moment, we're going forward. They are on foreign land.
Up on this plinth, in this square here, there would have been a Russian statue. My translator think it may have been a statue of Lenin, but the Ukrainians have been pulling down these statues, trying to erase any Russian culture or signs of Russian culture in areas they take. But now this is back under Russian control, this town.
These last 8 years, we've been living under humiliation. And when the Russian soldiers came, we've been waiting for them. But we are also Russians. We understand Russians. We think and live like Russians do. That's why we were waiting for them.
First of all, I think it will be easier to breathe. We do not understand yet. Our fear is that the Russian military will move on and leave the town without defense, and that we will be under shelling again.
I am taken to a townhouse which served as a Ukrainian military base. The remnants of what the soldiers left as they fled. They tried to hide tanks here, but the building was still struck by a Russian airstrike. Now these are pictures drawn by children, quite possibly sent to the Ukrainian soldiers. These ones here say, "We want peace." This one here says, "Please return alive." As the Russian army continues their advance in Donbass, more towns like this, in the coming days and weeks, will raise the Russian flag. Meanwhile, civilians throughout the Donbass, whether pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, will be hoping that this war will soon come to an end.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, a belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy, accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the crimes against humanity that are being committed by apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the Pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews, that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason is very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer, but they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
I think it's because Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer was not obedient, and he continued to advocate for Palestine and against the crimes of the State of Israel, and they decided to bring him to heel in an exemplary way. You know, they've pretty much cleaned out the Labour Party. They've got scalps there. They've attacked people in academia. They got people fired in Bristol. They've even tried to take on musicians like Lowkey.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Saeed Bouriza, London.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome, known for having overseen an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation. Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed a plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan has concluded his 11-day trip to the country. Holding a press conference in Kabul, Richard Bennett expressed concern about the violation of human rights in Afghanistan, calling on the Taliban to abide by their promises.
Afghanistan is facing a plethora of critical human rights challenges that are having a severe impact on the population. I urge the authorities to acknowledge the human rights challenges that they are facing and to close the gap between their words and their deeds.
Mr. Bennett also called for investigation into blind terror attacks in the country, saying systematic attacks on Shia Hazaras involve marks of crimes against humanity.
I call for investigations into a series of attacks on places of worship and schools in Kabul, Kunduz, and Balkh provinces, instances of which have been claimed by the ISISK group. In particular, such attacks, specifically targeting members of the Hazara, Shia, and Sufi communities, are becoming increasingly systematic in nature and reflect elements of an organizational policy, thus bearing the hallmarks of crimes against humanity.
The UN expert also urged the international community to continue relief funds to Afghanistan, saying sanctions on the Taliban should not harm the Afghan people.
The humanitarian and economic crisis is very concerning, and I call on the international community to continue to provide humanitarian support and to ensure that the implementation of applicable sanctions do not substantially impede the provision of essential public services accessible to all, which are necessary for the enjoyment of human rights.
The independent expert advised the Taliban to form an inclusive government and establish fair engagement with the people if they want to end instability and suffering on Afghan soil. The UN expert's trip to Afghanistan comes as the country has been facing rights violations in different aspects. Afghan people hope their rights are protected and the international community closely watches developments in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised to move the country closer to the United States, expanding trade and strengthening the military alliance. When Yoon recently hosted a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, he went so far as to place his hand over his heart during the American national anthem, drawing condemnation from many South Koreans, including activists critical of U.S.-South Korea ties.
I believe it destroyed Koreans' pride. How can the president of one country do such a thing? I think Yoon Suk-yeol is a pro-American token.